Hey, everybody. Welcome to another round of Ask Joe. I am Joe Gilder from HomeStudioCorner.com. If you have a question for me, you can ask it at AskJoeGilder.com. That'll take you to the right place to ask your questions. Keep them brief, and I'll try to answer them. So I'm going to jump right into the questions and just get things rolling today. One kind of funny question I got just earlier today, I believe. One of my VIP members was asking me. He said, I was listening to the podcast. I believe it was Baba from India. And he was asking, he said, I was listening to the podcast and I've got to know who played that song for the intro music. Where can I get it? I have to have it. And so I was a little flattered because it's actually my song that I wrote and obviously recorded and mixed and mastered. And everything on there but the bass and the drums is me. So anyway, it's a song called Behold. And currently I haven't actually released that song for public consumption of any kind. So that will probably happen. I'm working on a full album right now. I've got probably about halfway through the recording phase. And so that's it. I may include it as a part of that album, or it may end up being its own single. I don't know what it's going to be. But currently, the only way to get that song in its entirety, I've given it to Production Club members. So if you're a member of the Production Club over at hscproductionclub.com, that's actually the song that we work through as a part of the Production Club. So if you're not familiar with that, we work through an entire song from start to finish in the Production Club, and that is actually the song. So it's a big song, lots of, you know, live drums, lots of guitars, bass, even a choir at the end. It was a lot of fun to do, and we worked through the whole thing there. So if you are not a member and you're thinking about joining, if you want a good single-stop place to go for everything in the production process, start to finish, from pre-production all the way through to finished master, it's a 19-week course, and it's a little expensive, and it's definitely an investment, but it's no more than what you'd spend on a good microphone or preamp, things like that. But it can definitely help you get over maybe that hump that you're facing of not really sure what all it takes to finish a song, and you get to do one with me as we work through the song, so it's pretty cool. So enough about that. You can check out that more. See if it's a good fit for you at hscproductionclub.com. A lot of folks really enjoying it. But let's jump into the questions. I'm almost back on schedule this week. We're starting on a Wednesday this week. We'll get back to normal Tuesdays next week. But let's see what we can do. First question up is from Tariq about drum mixing. And he asks, what part of drum mixing should be mixed in mono? Or what part of a drum should be mixed in mono? What parts should be mixed in stereo? Can you give a general rule? Bullet list, thanks for all your help. I'm getting closer to conquering the routing troubles I was having in contact. Oh, that was something we were emailing about earlier. Good question. What should be mixed in mono? Well, if I'm not exactly sure what you mean by mixed in mono versus mixed in stereo, but I'll answer the way I mix drums. For me, almost 100% of the time, I'm mixing the kick and the snare drums are dead center. I don't do any panning with those at all. Dead center. And then the overheads, I have panned left and right. Stereo, if it's the room mics, if they're stereo, they'll be panned left and right. Not always hard panned left and right, especially if you use a wider recording technique for the drums, for the overheads especially. Sometimes panning it hard left and right can give you a really almost obnoxiously wide stereo image. So if the drummer hits the left, far left crash cymbal and then comes over here and hits the far right one, it can almost sound too wide and too distracting. So sometimes, a lot of times I'll end up panning those maybe 75% left or right. There's no real rule there. Just listen to it. If it sounds weird, narrow it down a little bit. And then the toms, I will just pan. I like to pan from drummer's perspective. So as if I'm sitting at the kit, snare and kick in the middle. If there's, say, three toms, I'll pan the first tom a little to the left, second tom a little to the right, and the floor tom further to the right. If it's two toms, I'll pan one left, one right. So it has some sort of a width to it. And hi-hat, I'll usually pan to the left if I'm using the hi-hat. There's a lot of times I'll just turn the hi-hat track off because it gets picked up enough in the overheads, and I don't feel like I really need that hi-hat to really get done what I'm trying to get done. And that's generally my approach. Now, obviously, there's a lot more to it, EQ, compression, and all that. But as far as panning, which is what you're asking about, that's what I do. Next up is a question from Kim. And Kim was asking about, you know what, that was something we emailed about. We're good. Next up is Gregory from Belize. He says, can I record studio quality songs with a podcast studio by Behringer and Cakewalk Music Creator 6? And I'll answer this question as if you didn't mention a particular product, because there are tons of products out there, And my general answer is yes. Yes, you can record quality songs with just about anything. Anything that's out there that was designed for recording. So not the built-in microphone on your laptop, but an actual audio interface, microphones, and things like that. It's certainly possible to get a good recording. Now, if you go super cheap with recording, I interviewed, if you're not familiar with Ronan from Ronan's recording show, his name's Ronan Chris Murphy. He's definitely got a cool show you should check out. It's a video blog where he does fairly regular podcast or video podcast episodes. And Ronan's the real deal. He's worked on records all over the country. He holds his own recording boot camps. He's just a cool guy. But he, I interviewed him for my VIP members and in one of our monthly VIP sessions that we do. And one of the things, the points that he made that really stuck with me is that generally anything you can buy today, generally, is going to be capable of giving you a good sound. However, if you go too cheap with the gear, suddenly it can start to damage the sound. So does that mean you need a $1,000 microphone? Not at all. But it could mean that a $50 microphone is just not at least up to the quality that at least captures the sound somewhat accurately. So it doesn't have to be super high end, but if it's bottom of the barrel, it might actually be degrading the sound before it ever gets into your computer, before you can manipulate it. So can I give you a specific number as to what to spend on those? No, I can't. I will say some people tend to think of Behringer stuff as on the cheaper end, not sounding very good or not lasting very long. And I can't speak to that. I've not owned much Behringer stuff. I have heard stories of people with Behringer gear failing, but at the same time, I've heard that about almost every other brand out there. So I don't feel like there's a lot of weight there. But I mean, I think Behringer would agree that their Behringer equipment is on the lower price point. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad, but your best bet with a specific piece of gear is to go out there, find somebody who's used it. Forums can be a great place for that. People who have used it and give their experience, their honest experience with it. And as far as software, that's even more, there's even less of an issue with software because it's just software. It just takes the audio that you put into it and manipulates it. So if as long as it's designed to do recording, you can make a great album with GarageBand. I've talked about this before on a year or two ago on a podcast here on the Home Studio Corner podcast. I had my buddy Ben Gortmaker on here and he recorded an entire really, really good album using GarageBand. If you've ever used GarageBand, that's the recording software that comes with a Mac. So if you buy a MacBook Pro or whatever Mac you want, it comes with GarageBand. And it is very limited. And Ben would be the first one to tell you that it's a very limited piece of software. However, he was able to take the basic features of GarageBand and make a really, really good sounding album. Now, there's a lot of clips on that podcast. Go back. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I forget which episode it is. But it was one of the last episodes I did before switching this over to Ask Joe. Format. So go back through the Ask Joe the podcast archives and you'll see it there. Really good quality stuff. I recommend going and buying it. He's a buddy of mine supporting independent music. But hopefully, Greg, that answers your question. I think you can as long as it's a decent piece of equipment. The real variable in all of this is you and how good you are and how good the musicians are that you're recording. If you're not very good with your technique, it doesn't matter what equipment you buy. I've told this story before. There was a guy, when I sold equipment at Sweetwater, there was a customer. I don't know if he was my customer. It's been so long. But he had purchased something like a Neumann TLM-103 or possibly one of the higher-end $2,000 plus mics. Maybe a U87. It might have been one of the TLM-67 maybe. Anyway, they're very expensive, very nice microphones. And I believe he got a nice preamp to go with it. And he recorded something and sent it in to his sales guy saying, listen to what I recorded. And he forwarded it to me and we listened to it and it was just not good. Now, this isn't to say that at Sweetwater we're making fun of customers, not at all. It literally sounded like he had put a big wool sock over the microphone and faced the microphone away from the source and recorded something. Was the problem the microphone? No. It was just his technique and his room and his performance and all those other things. And there's nothing wrong with not having good technique. Nobody's just born with good recording technique. You can be born with a good ear for music and a good ear for coming up with parts and writing songs and playing and all those things. But to figure out how to take that microphone and make it capture the sound that you want, that really just comes down to practice and technique. And those are the things you can learn. That's a big part, a huge part. The only reason I do Home Studio Corner is to teach people that technique stuff. It's stuff that I didn't just know innately. I learned from other people. I learned from doing it myself. And it's stuff you can learn too. And I just, that's why I make a lot of tutorial products and things like that and sell them, because some people want to learn it quickly and in a very organized, straightforward fashion without having to go find bits and pieces all over the place. And that's why I do it. And a lot of people tell me it helps them with their technique and their mixes are getting better. And that's fun. I really like it. And that's why I do this podcast. I love answering these questions. It's a lot of fun. So you guys ask really good questions, which makes it makes it more fun too. So heading over from Belize to Brazil, we've got Lugo. Lugo asks, should I record with compression and why? That's a good question. I've gotten that question before, and I'm sure I've written about it a couple times on the website. So if you do a search for compression on homestudiocorner.com, I'm sure you'll find something there. But the question of should I, I've talked about this before. I feel like I'm a broken record, but I have a blog post that says two words you should never say in the home in a home studio or in a studio, and that those two words are should I. So I'm going to make a quick point here, and then I'll actually answer your question. But the question of should I do this in the studio, should I do that, or is it wrong if I do this? Is it okay if I'm doing this in the studio? The answer is it's wrong if you don't like it, and it's okay if you do like it. If you come across some weird way of recording an electric guitar amp where you put the microphone in another room facing a corner, but it sounds amazing, is it wrong? No, it's awesome. You came up with a cool new technique that works for your particular amp on that particular day. But to say that that was wrong, some people would say, yes, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. You should put the microphone at a 45-degree angle right in front of the cone, facing between the cone and the edge of the speaker. And so people do that, and it does sound fine, but maybe there's other ways of doing things that would sound even better, especially on a given day with a given performance in a given room. There's so many variables, you can't just have hard and fast rules. So that's my little speech, is you should always be experimenting with things. I'm especially learning that with my new guitar, which, oh, I forgot to tell you about. It's a Les Paul Studio, and it's a beautiful Pelham blue color. I put a picture up on the Facebook page, which you can see. And I'll do a full review on the site with pictures and all that stuff eventually. But it's beautiful. It's my first Gibson. And it's actually my first nice electric guitar. I've had a nice acoustic guitar for a while. And I've only really been playing electric guitar for a couple years, really. I've been playing acoustic for 15 years or something. But I've only been playing electric for a few years. And I've gotten to the point where I'm pretty good at it. And I'm playing it regularly enough to warrant getting an actual nicer guitar. Anyway, the thing I'm learning now is I've got this guitar and this amp and this pedal board, and now I'm dialing in the tone. And there are so, if you think there are so many variables with regular recording, you should try, with just recording, you should try getting into guitars if you're not. Because there are a bajillion low-cost guitar pedals out there, and you could set them up in a gajillion different ways, and there's no real or right or wrong answer. There's different guitars that go on the front end, there's different amps that go on the back end, and every single rig is going to sound a little different from the other. So it's all about, you'll go on those forums. I go to one, it's a Les Paul forum. I think it's mylespaul.com. Really cool site. They're really helpful over there, and I haven't even joined, but I've been scouring the forums and getting a lot of information from them, which is great. But they talk about, they'll give a lot of suggestions, but they'll say at the end of the day, try it in your system and see if you like it. Because if you like it, then it's right. So that's what I would say for you. Should you record with compression? Maybe. Am I recording with compression right now? Yes, I've got a little bit of compression going on my Eureka preamp. I actually got a little bit of EQ because I'm actually using a different microphone today. It's a head-worn mic I'm experimenting with. And because it's so close to my mouth, I've got some of the low frequencies rolled off, and I'm already using some compression because I know I want it to be compressed in the final mix, so I'm going ahead and adding some on the front end. Why am I doing that? Well, I know how to use compression, and so I know how to set it up. And I'm looking at the compressor right now, and I don't really have it set up the way I should. It's still got settings from when I recorded bass, so not necessarily the best setup right now, but I've got just a light bit of compression. It may or may not be doing a whole lot to the sound. I'll compress it more after the fact when I mix this podcast. All that to say, if you've got outboard compression, go for it. Use it. And certainly you can compress after the fact using plugins. Now, one thing to note, you can put a compressor on your track as you're recording, but generally the way that works is you're just hearing the sound of the compression. You're not actually recording that compression to the tape. So it's, you're recording the bare audio, and then it's running that audio through a compressor plugin, and that's what you're hearing. So putting a compressor plugin on the track as you're recording isn't doing anything to the sound except changing what you hear coming out of your speakers. So that can be a good thing or a bad thing, just depending on if you need to hear that or not. But otherwise, if you don't have hardware compression, you don't necessarily need it to get a good recording. If I had a choice, I would take a nice preamp, record everything dry with no compression, and then add compression as I need later. If you know you're going to use compression later, then maybe you go ahead and add some during recording and make your life a little bit easier. But all in all, it's just about trying things and seeing what you like. Now, that was a really long answer to a really short question, but I thought there were a few points in there that needed to be made. So thanks for the question, Lugo. Okay. Next up, if you hear my kid crying in the next room, he's not happy. Next up is Brandon from San Francisco. Brandon is asking about stereo instrument recording. He says, I'm considering buying a pair of pencil mics so I can record my guitar in stereo. I already have one condenser, which I use as my workhorse right now. What do you think about buying another single microphone and pairing it up with my only mic rather than getting a paired set? This is a good question. A lot of folks are into getting matched pairs of microphones, either a matched set of small diaphragm pencil condensers or a matched set of large diaphragm condensers. And there's this kind of glow and aura around the idea of having two identical microphones. Now, from a technical standpoint, yes, to technically capture a perfect stereo image, perfect is in quotes, you need two identical signal paths capturing the left and right area of the source you're recording. So ideally, you have two of the exact same microphone going into two of the exact same preamps using the exact same cables and all that stuff. In reality, is it wrong if you use two completely different microphones into two completely different preamps? No, there's nothing wrong with that at all. For me, that's what I did. I had a single large diaphragm condenser, and then I actually won another one in a song competition. So I had two. One was a regular condenser, one was a tube mic. And they sounded very different, but I wanted to do stereo miking. So I put one left, one right, into two different preamps because I didn't have two of the same preamp. I mean, I was completely just winging it. And you know what? The recordings turned out pretty cool. I had to kind of, obviously it wasn't a true stereo recording in that both sides were the same. Both sides sounded very different just because of the different signal path, but it still worked and it still captured that nice wide stereo sound. So I'm all for both. At this point, I've got several large diaphragm condensers, and I've got three of the same Earthworks mics. And so if I'm doing stereo recording, I'll usually use two of those to do that. But if I only had at my disposal just two random microphones, I would use those two and go for it. That said, on my current album I'm working on, I'm actually recording all the acoustic guitars using one microphone. And I'm not saying that's what you should do. For me, I wanted to just sit down and play, and I wanted to make it as simple as possible. So for me, that meant one microphone, one preamp, one good recording. And a part of the decision to do that was that I've only got one of these PreSonus Eureka preamps, and I really like them, but I only have one. So I'm not going to buy a second one just so I can do some stereo miking, and I didn't want to run one mic through the Eureka and one mic through my mixer preamps. Even though they would sound fine, like I just said, I just wanted one really good sound instead of a really nice preamp sound on one mic and then a cheaper preamp sound on the other. So that was one microphone sitting right in front of the guitar and recording from about a foot, foot and a half away. And it's sounding very, very good. I'll be sure to post some links and some sound clips here eventually. But that would be my answer to you, Brandon, is if you already have one mic, rather than buying two, if you can do it, go for it. If not, just get a second mic and go to town learning, because stereo mic recording is a big learning process. So the sooner you can just get that second mic and start trying things, the better you'll be. Next up is Eugenie from Siberia, Russia. Awesome. Says, is there some special digital frequency? I often hear too, quote, digital and non-realistic sound, especially on hi-hat and crash tracks when I use electronic drums. Is there a way to make it sound more natural using EQ? You know what? That's a really good question, Eugenie, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering your last name. But essentially what you're asking is you're using drum samples and they don't sound very real, especially the cymbals. And I will tell you, you're not alone. Just about anybody who's used any sort of a drum software, drum programming software, drum samples, even from a keyboard back in the 80s, would tell you that one of the hardest things to reproduce is a realistic cymbal sound. They usually sound really harsh. And you mentioned the hi-hat as well. Hi-hat can be a little easier, but in general, it's kind of hard to make it sound real. You can get the kick and snare maybe sounding pretty good, but the cymbals just don't work very well. One solution to that, and something a lot of people do, is they actually buy a cymbal or two, and instead of buying a whole drum kit, they'll just buy a cymbal or two and just record those crashes with actual microphones and then blend that with the fake drums. That's one thing you could do. I personally wouldn't do that. I don't do it enough. I record real drums now, but if I was doing a fake drum set, I'd figure out a way to make those samples sound right. Another thing could be that your samples just aren't that good. And that's not a knock against you, but there's good quality stuff and there's bad quality stuff. And I talk all the time about getting it right at the source. And when you're using a lot of samples and virtual instruments and things like that, your source is the actual samples that you're using. So if they're bad samples and they don't sound that good, there's not much I can do for you as far as fixing it. Because like we always say, you can't really fix it in the mix. You've got to get it right at the source. Now, to answer your question as far as can you do anything with EQ, when I've used really bad samples, or for that matter, a bad recording of overheads, cymbals, hi-hats, generally there's something in the upper mids that's causing a problem and that harshness. It's anywhere from 1 to 3K up to maybe 4 or 5 kilohertz. And that's generally the range that just has some buildup and some harshness. If things are harsh, that's usually where it's happening for me in my experience. So if I go do some sort of a wide cut there to just take those frequencies down a little bit, a lot of times it'll soften up the cymbals. Sometimes it may be something down in the mid-range. Maybe there's a weird resonance at 500 hertz that's causing it to sound weird. Try cutting there. It's just an experiment thing. But I do find if it's sounding harsh, sometimes taking away those extra mids, tend to sound kind of fake. If you can take some of those out, sometimes that can help. Really good question, though. Loving these questions. Next up is Dane Jolly from Perth, Western Australia. We are just hitting all the continents again today. I don't think we've had a single American. Yeah, we had Brandon from San Francisco, but international folks are bringing it today. His question is, or her, I'm not sure. Dane, I think that's a male name. Says, I'm building a house, and of course, I want to make sure that I have a killer dedicated home studio. My girlfriend has made me agree to share a space with the home cinema, so that got me thinking. What are your thoughts? Is it important to have a dedicated live room and a separate control room? What about shape? Circular, rectangular, square? What about floorboards versus carpet or tiles? Am I best to create a completely dead space? What about the walls and acoustic treatment? Okay, so that's probably 5 questions, so I can't cover all of those. But I'll tell you, in general, is it better to have a separate control room and a live recording room? Better, it depends. For me, that wouldn't be very good because a lot of the recording I do is myself. So having a separate live room would just mean there's a room over there where there's no one to record because I want to be in the room with the computer and all the software so I can record something, go make some changes, and go back and record. Now, you could get some sort of transport control device like the PreSonus fader port that I've talked about that I use and run a long cable to the next room so you can control the software from there. But in general, for me, having a second room just for recording wouldn't make as much sense. I'd rather have one room, maybe a bigger room, where I can have one end for the control room, the other end for recording. Now, if you're recording other people and having a lot of clients come in and full bands and things like that, then yeah, having a second room is great. So you can listen to things on your monitors, make adjustments, and not be hearing the direct instrument. So it depends on what you're trying to do. As far as room shape, you asked about circular versus square, rectangle. Your best bet is going to be a rectangular room. A square will have way too many issues. A circular room will have lots of issues because it's essentially sending all those frequencies bouncing back into the middle of the room. If you get a rectangular room, like we talked about, I believe, last week, you can at least control the dimensions of the room to get a decent sound and minimize how many different frequencies are going to give you problems, and then use bass trapping in the corners and absorption and things like that. You don't necessarily need to make it a dead room. Just use enough treatment, enough absorption to where it's not a super live room to where when you clap your hands, that sound just bounces around for 5 seconds. That's not what you want. But you also don't want it to sound like a big dead vocal booth because that can be, that sounds really unnatural. It weirds me out to be in a room like that, just because there needs to be some sound bouncing around the room, but you just want to limit that. And that's what absorption and bass trapping and things like that can do. And as far as your other questions, that generally covers it. Those are the 2 main questions you had. And the rest, I would refer you, I've got a lot of articles on the website about acoustic treatment, and I've got a product that I talked about last week called Understanding Your Room, which might be worth looking at, especially if you're looking to build from the ground up. It kind of walks you through the entire thought process of acoustic treatment and how your room interacts with sound and ways to make sure that you're doing everything you need to do to get it right the first time. Great question. Next up is Maurier from France asking about microphones. It says, ribbon mic versus condenser mic. What is the difference and use of each? Which would be better for a home studio for vocals? Well, I'll give you the quick difference. There's basically three types of microphones. There's dynamic microphones or moving coil mics. There's condenser mics and there's ribbon mics. Typically, ribbons and condensers are the nicer, higher-end, more expensive microphones. A condenser microphone has an electric charge to it. I'm oversimplifying it because you've probably heard me explain this a million times. Condenser microphone is more sensitive. There's a charged plate in there. It's very sensitive, so it picks up the full frequency spectrum very well. Generally tends to have a lot more detail to it, a lot more high-end to it, because it's picking up, again, all that extra detail. It has a higher frequency response. Now, they can sound wildly different from large diaphragm to small diaphragm to tube mics to, and even within all of those, they can sound very clean or very dark, very warm. There's lots of sounds to those. That's why there's a bajillion of them out there to choose from. Ribbon microphones are more like a dynamic microphone than a condenser. They've got an actual ribbon that's floating in space, and sound moves that ribbon, which generates a tiny little bit of electricity, which is then transferred into audio. So for a ribbon microphone, they typically, they don't have a lot of output. Because you send 48-volt phantom power to a condenser microphone, it has a fairly hot output. So any preamp generally can handle a condenser mic and give you a nice, healthy level. With a ribbon microphone, however, it's a very, very low signal. I want to say it's even lower than most dynamic microphones. And because of that, sometimes a preamp won't have enough gain to get that signal up to a nice line level. And so you need a nice dedicated preamp with a lot of gain to really get the most out of your ribbon microphones. That can be the same for a dynamic as well. And as far as sound, ribbon microphones tend to be very warm. They tend to kind of roll off the high end and have a nice smooth sound, but they also tend to be very dark. So if I had to choose just one, if I was starting a new home studio from scratch and I had to have one microphone, it would not be a ribbon. Ribbons are great. They can be great in front of guitar cabinets. They can be great for vocal sometimes, but they're just not very versatile. A condenser microphone kind of captures everything, and then you can use EQ to kind of shape that tone how you want it to be, and it's just more versatile. So condenser microphone, especially if you're looking for just one, I'd go with that. A ribbon mic is kind of a nice extra mic to have, but not your first go-to mic, if that makes sense. Okay, next up is Philippe, and Philippe is from Brazil. He has two questions about clip signal masking. First is about analog. Says you're recording a singer through your Presonus Eureka channel strip, and you set a compression setting to catch some peaks. Is it possible for the audio to clip before the compressor? If so, there is benefit of using a channel strip to catch peaks before the signal goes into the DAW. It is possible for it to peak before it hits the compressor, and that's why you look at the preamp section. The preamp has a little 3-light meter that shows you when it's got signal at negative 20 dB. It shows you when it's got signal at 0 dB, which in the analog realm is not clipping yet. And then it's got an actual clip light. So I'm looking at it right now. I'm lighting up the first 2 lights with my mic, but not the clip light, so I know it's not clipping. So it's got a clip indicator there before it hits the compressor. Then I can use the compressor to tame down some of the peaks, and then it goes out into my recording software. So no, it's not going to prevent the preamp from clipping itself, if that makes sense. You'll keep it from clipping the output of the channel strip with a compressor, but you can't prevent it from clipping the preamp, because the preamp is the very first step in the process. And your other question has to do with the digital domain. It says, you're processing a single channel in your DAW. You put an EQ and a compressor. Imagine you boost the EQ a lot, and it indicates that the output signal was clipping. But the compressor acts, and when you watch your channel signal, the mix window says the audio is not clipping. Does the signal get damaged, or it depends on the bit depth supported by the plugins? That's going to be more of an it depends question, because depending on how your EQ plugin handles the signal, it may be a floating point bit depth thing, which I don't really understand. It doesn't really affect me in the real world. But know that some plugins, if you drive them into clipping, it just adjusts and it doesn't actually ever clip the audio. Other plugins, it will clip, just like a piece of analog equipment would. Is the clipping bad? Well, it depends if you can hear it. If you can't hear it and it sounds okay, then go for it. But a general rule of thumb I like to go by is if something is clipping, I try to prevent that from clipping. So just because it shows that it's not clipping on your fader or in the compressor, if it shows that it's clipping in the EQ, then it is clipping. It's not lying to you. And I would dial that back and ease up on that. And that's all has to do with gain staging. And gain staging is simply all about making sure that every stage of the process has a nice level that's not too low and not too high, so you get a nice clean signal, good processing without a lot of noise and without any clipping. So the more, generally, any plugin I put in the chain, I want to have it set to where if I bypass that plugin, everything coming through that plugin is still roughly at the same volume. So it's generally, I'm keeping the gain staging, quote unquote, correct. So when I bypass the EQ, it's still the same volume. Now, how does that work? Well, let's say I use EQ and I cut out a lot of mid-range using that EQ. Removing that mid-range is going to remove some volume from that track. So I maybe need to use the output gain of that EQ to bring it up a couple dB. So when I bypass, it sounds the same volume before and after. I do the same thing with compression most of the time too. And that's how I make sure that I'm not clipping anything along the way. But good question. You should always keep an eye on these things and make sure that you're not moving too quickly and that you're not clipping a bunch of stuff that you don't mean to. And with that question, I will wrap this one up. There's a bunch more questions here. We'll try to get to them next week. But again, it's been a long day and my voice is kind of tired. So I'm gonna wrap this one up and get it up to you. If you want to check out all the show notes, there's a few links that I'll be putting in there. You can check that out at homestudiocorner.com/askjoe33. That's askjoe33, no dashes, no spaces. And you can find all the show notes there to some of the things I talked about today. And if you are listening to this podcast and you haven't signed up for my daily newsletter, I would encourage you to. I send out a daily tip early in the morning, every weekday, that has to do all about recording. So if you're into that sort of stuff, you like recording as much as I do, definitely get on that list. It's got a lot of good stuff there. And I'll tell you about some of the products that I make that are helping a lot of people make better recordings. So yes, I do put a link to my products in those emails and tell you about those as well. And you can always unsubscribe if you're not into it, but got a lot of really good subscribers. If you're a subscriber, thank you for subscribing. You guys are great. All the replies I get back from you, the interactions, and it's just a lot of fun. And you guys are out there making music, getting better. It's really fun to see and to watch. So it's amazing to me to think that Home Studio Corner has been around for over 3 years, and I'm not planning on quitting anytime soon. So I'll keep it coming if you guys will keep showing up, asking good questions, and especially applying the stuff that you learn. I'm not the end. The buck doesn't stop here. There are plenty of things I don't know. I don't know everything. I just know the stuff that I've learned in my experience and from other people. And everybody's at a different stage in the process of learning. But as long as you're coming to my website, you're learning things and taking those things and applying them, then you're in good shape, because applying stuff and practicing and actually using the things you learn is how you get better. And that applies to obviously everything, not just recording. But since this is a recording podcast, I thought I'd throw that out there. So thanks again for listening. Hope this was helpful for you. And we'll see you next week on a next episode of Ask Joe. Thanks.